From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents, context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
I'm from Benicia.
Sunset District.
I live in Lakeside.
The Western Addition.
Diamond Heights.
Emeryville, California.
Westwood Park.
Coming up, we'll hear how the 2011 nuclear explosion in Fukushima, Japan, has changed the way residents think about food and the ramifications on food safety here in California.
So basically, if you see grown in Fukushima, to you that means safe.
Yes. Yes.
Then we'll talk about a play that gives California's earthquake fault lines some very human personality traits.
They eat In-N-Out burgers. They watch, you know, porn shoots, and they have worries about if people are going to like them.
Living with natural disasters, coming up today on Cross Currents. We are no strangers to earthquakes here in the Bay Area, but there's been nothing in recent memory to match the 9.0 quake that shook Japan on March 11, 2011. The quake set off a deadly tsunami and was so powerful, it shifted the Earth's axis by several inches. But the news that came out of Japan the next day gripped the world with fear. A nuclear explosion at the Fukushima Daiichi power plant. Reactors melted down, releasing giant plumes of radiation into the atmosphere. Here on the other edge of the Pacific Ocean, many were concerned, would it reach us? Over the years, this concern has not gone away. While radioactive cesium from Fukushima was detected 100 miles off the coast of Eureka, California this week, it's not nearly concentrated enough to raise flags for health concern. But if people are still worried here, 5,000 miles and an ocean away from the nuclear plant, what about there? How are people in Fukushima making sense of the health risks in their environment? And when it comes to one of the most daily necessities, food, how are they figuring out what's safe? KALW's Ali Budner traveled to Fukushima this summer to ask this question. She started at a grocery store.
Okay. I head towards the sliding doors of the supermarket. With the bright fluorescent lights and cheerful music, this could almost be a grocery store in my neighborhood. But I'm in Fukushima, Japan.
My name is Michio Kainuma. I was born in Fukushima Prefecture.
Fukushima, a name that evokes fear for some. But to Michio Kainuma, a spry 61-year-old English teacher and my guide at the supermarket, Fukushima is so much more than its radioactive reputation. It's home.
And green pepper. This is really cheap and fresh. And
I've met up with Kainuma to do perhaps one of the most basic and yet most controversial things you can do in a place after nuclear disaster. Prepare a meal.
I'm going to make tempura tonight and with using all of the fresh vegetables here.
Oh, beautiful. That sounds delicious.
Okay.
Yeah.
In front of us is a display of produce grown and packaged here in Fukushima.
Some onions here and potatoes.
A row of photographed faces are lined up above the food. They kind of look like baseball cards, but they're portraits of local farmers.
Who is handsome?
They all look handsome.
Despite the supermarket's promotion of local food and Kainuma's positive attitude, I'm wondering, what's really okay to eat here? Right after the nuclear plant exploded in Japan, I remember walking into a grocery store in San Francisco and noticing the big bulk bins of seaweed were all wiped clean. People thought it would protect them from the radiation that might be drifting towards them from across the Pacific. But ironically, as people scurried to protect themselves here, some people much closer to the contamination didn't even know a nuclear meltdown had occurred.
Even the hydrogen explosion occurred, I didn't know that. Because we couldn't see TV.
Because you didn't have power.
Yeah.
And no one came to tell her.
No.
So when did you find out that there was radiation coming this direction and landing?
Maybe
on
10 days or 15 days.
Just after the earthquake, the Kainumas were focused on meeting their basic needs.
Food. I think the first thing I think about is food.
She and her family stood in a long line at this very grocery store, waiting to get what limited food was available. Radioactivity was far from their minds. They just didn't want to be hungry.
Of course, I knew about the explosion of the radioactive substances, I really worried about that invisible fear.
Invisible. As Kainuma said, they had no way of knowing how much danger they were in or where it was. One of the scariest things about radiation is we can't perceive it with any of our senses. Now Kainuma knows full well that her city was caught in the shadow of nuclear fallout. But here, buying food more than 3 years later, she shows little concern about it. As she shops, I wonder how she went from fearing irradiated food to enthusiastically buying local. It's not exactly because the farmers are handsome, though the pictures, she tells me, do help.
Every name is stick to the pictures, so we can see the farmer's face. That's really comfortable for us to choose what we want to buy.
Maybe patriotism plays a role, too. Kainuma's husband worked for the local government, and Kainuma herself has volunteered with them, distributing leaflets about efforts to monitor food.
So basically, if you see grown in Fukushima, to you that means safe.
Yes, yes.
She points out what she tells me is a unique inspection code on every bag of rice. There's even a phone number.
And it says it's toll-free dials, 012, la-la-la-la-la. You can see the information from here about this bag.
Have you ever called?
No.
You just trust.
Yeah, trust. Yeah, because I have been to the inspection center, and I can clearly see that its latest technology shows it is safe. So I perfectly trust all of them.
Trust. That might be what this all boils down to. As we check out and leave the store, I can't help thinking that shopping for food is a form of trust. After all, I often look for and trust labels that tell me whether the food I'm buying is organic or local. Of course, I might be more skeptical if I were watching out for nuclear radiation. And naturally, some people in Fukushima are.
My name is Chiaki Oku.
Oku is 56, and like Kainuma, she's an English teacher who lives in Fukushima Prefecture. Unlike Kainuma, she has completely changed her food habits.
I was worried about the food and water right after the accident.
Even though food from Fukushima is cheaper, she still buys milk and vegetables from other areas. I'm talking to her on Skype, and she brings her computer over to the kitchen. Going through the produce in her refrigerator is like a tour of all the other parts of Japan.
I have radish from Ibaraki Prefecture. And potatoes are made in Hokkaido.
After the disaster, Oku's children and grandchildren moved to a different part of Japan because of the radiation threat.
I was very sad and lonely and confused.
She decided to stay because, well, it was her home. I tell her about Michio Kainuma's trust in the government and the food system.
It's her choice. So I don't want to say it's danger. Don't eat this one or something. Depend on the people, the personal thinking.
She has a bad feeling about the vegetables.
Just only me, but I don't want to eat. I feel it.
So Oku's decisions about food, just like Michio Kainuma's, are based on trust, or lack thereof, a feeling in the gut. Understandably, she's overwhelmed when she imagines intensely restricting her shopping like this for the rest of her life.
Maybe I will eat that food in the future, near future. But from now, I have to take care of my body.
And she's not about to put her health in the hands of the government.
Japanese government say, don't worry, it's safe. But this is not true, I think.
Now, there are clear reasons why some people like Chiaki Oku don't trust the authorities. For one, the Japanese government, along with TEPCO, the company who owns and runs the nuclear plant, notoriously mishandled the meltdown disaster. And there's a revolving door between government and the nuclear industry in Japan. One group, the Union of Concerned Scientists, called it a perfect example of regulators being too close to the industry they oversee. And it's regulators from that same government overseeing the food supply. But there are ways people can test their food directly. There are 26 food monitoring centers in Fukushima, just for homegrown produce, like this one.
Taking our shoes off and putting on plastic slippers to go inside the food monitoring center.
At this center, you walk across squeaky blue sticky mats that keep you from tracking in extra dirt, dust, or anything from the outside world that might be contaminated with radiation.
People were extremely concerned about food safety and their products. So we built centers like the one you're standing in with devices you see here.
Kenichi Hanzawa is the technical official at this monitoring center. Stout cylindrical machines stand at attention on short tripod legs. They look like cousins of R2-D2, and they're designed to measure becquerels, units of radioactivity. Hanzawa demonstrates the nearly silent machine with a sample of rice. The whole thing is faster than an ATM transaction. This rice checks out. It's under the new local standard, 100 becquerels of radioactive cesium per kilogram. To put that in context, that's 12 times more strict than the U.S. radiation standard. For the first year, the center was swamped.
We would get phone calls from people who wanted to come here. Some would get very upset, and some were even in tears. It created an atmosphere of panic.
These centers have been vital in calming that panic. Since so many people in Fukushima grow their own food, being able to test it for radiation can be like giving people glasses to let them see what's otherwise an invisible threat. But Fukushima is also a big commercial farming region. These farmers have had their own set of problems. This orchard is in a valley green with peach trees, alive with crickets and cicadas.
My name is Shinichi Katahira.
Katahira is a fourth-generation peach farmer and owner of Michinoku Orchard, in the part of Fukushima known as the Fruit Line. This used to be the second largest peach-growing region in the country. It's far enough inland that they didn't really suffer from the earthquake or tsunami. But the next day, when the power plant exploded,
we were advised to evacuate, and we thought, it's all over.
Katahira's orchard is about 40 miles away from the power plant, not close enough to be officially evacuated, though many people did leave.
But for people like us, farmers who own this land and work on this land, we couldn't just pick up and leave. So we waited for more information.
Eventually, he decided to stay and continue farming. But there were some obvious obstacles. How would he guarantee his crops were safe? Katahira and other farmers consulted with experts at the local university.
The first thing we decided to do was to use high-pressure washers to wash the bark of these trees. Since it's all fallen on the ground, our next step was removing the upper 5 centimeters of the soil. That's a lot of soil that has to be moved.
And there was no official place for it to go. With limited resources, they trusted what becomes conventional wisdom after a nuclear disaster. Radioactive cesium, once bound to clay, doesn't travel much.
We buried the contaminated soil in about a half acre of our land, just a little ways from here.
Not all farmers in Fukushima have pressed on. Some people were forced to leave their contaminated land. Fukushima Prefecture used to be the fourth largest rice producer in Japan, but has dropped to seventh.
Life has changed a lot. It'll never be the same as before the accident.
As we leave, he gestures to his trees.
Please, try my peaches.
I indulge.
Oh, this one looks good.
Katahira says he's constantly testing his fruit to make sure it's safe. And standing here under his trees, I believe him. But will people buy it if they have the choice? Should they? That begs the question, how dangerous is radiation in our food? What do we know about how it affects our health? We know that one very large dose from a bomb or a meltdown can cause death or severe sickness. But there's also naturally occurring radiation all around us, in the air, soil, even in food. Bananas, for example, contain 130 becquerels per kilogram of radioactive potassium. That's higher than the level of radioactive cesium Fukushima allows in its food. Doctors and researchers, including from the National Academy of Sciences, are concerned about the increased risks for cancer and genetic mutations. But they still haven't determined the exact impacts of low doses of radiation over time. So that's more uncertainty, which itself can harm people's health. The World Health Organization concluded that in Fukushima, like in Chernobyl, the chronic stress of the nuclear accident could outweigh other health problems. What if you thought about radiation every time you went shopping, or ate, or cooked?
We are going to make sushi and tempura and noodles.
Okay. Could you help me?
I would love to help you.
I'm at Michio Kainuma's home now, watching her prepare dinner. Rice and vegetables for tempura.
2 cups of rice.
Kainuma cooks traditionally, carefully considering every detail of the meal. She listens to the changing pitch of the tempura oil as it bubbles. She watches the color of the boiling meat.
So now you see on the surface of the oil, bubbling.
But what's the protocol for an ingredient that can't be sensed? We all have our own way of dealing with the unknown. The Kainumas choose to eat locally.
Itadakimasu! Cheers!
At the end of the meal, Kainuma's husband turns on his favorite classical music while she slices up fruit for dessert. She asks me if I want a peach.
How about a bite of peaches? Fukushima peach?
Peaches, the symbol of Fukushima City. Fukushima has a long way to go before it solves its problems with radiation, the future of food production, and the dislocation of residents. But larger questions loom too. Japan is crisscrossed by fault lines. All 48 of the country's nuclear power reactors remain shut down in the wake of the Fukushima disaster. But industry and government leaders are pushing to reopen one in the coming year. And here in California, the active Diablo Canyon nuclear power plant sits just miles from fault lines. So while we don't understand the full impact of nuclear fallout on our food and our health, maybe we should try a little harder to grasp it, because it could just be a matter of time before something like Fukushima happens again, in Japan or here. Until the long-term studies are done, though, people have to feel their way through this disorienting and invisible threat. As I savor this slice of Fukushima peach, I feel connected in some small way to the land where it grew, and to the people I've met who still have to navigate between trust and fear. For KALW Radio and the San Francisco State Fukushima Reporting Project, I'm Ali Budner.
That piece was produced in partnership with the San Francisco State University Fukushima Reporting Project. Special thanks to William McMichael, John Funabiki, Gary Sakamoto, Nicole Martinez, and the Fukushima University Ambassadors Program. You can see images from Ali's visit to Fukushima at KALW.org. Click on Cross Currents. This is Cross Currents. I'm Hanat Baba. The devastation in Fukushima was a reality check for many of us who live in areas that are prone to natural disaster. Here in the Bay Area, one local playwright found the best way to grapple with the risk of living so close to a fault line is best expressed through theater. The play Faulted follows one character's prediction on the next big California earthquake and her struggle to convince everyone else before it's too late. KLW's Julie Kane spoke to the play's director, Evren Odjakin, and Deborah Eleazar, who plays the lead role of Aurora in the show. They talked about what it means to face one of our biggest collective fears.
Evren, you're the director of the play. Can you tell me just a little bit about what Faulted is about?
Faulted is about an empath who lives in Los Angeles who can sense earthquakes, and Deborah plays Aurora. That's the name of the empath. And she feels that the big one is coming. And then the play sort of leads up to that moment. The fun thing about the play is that four fault lines are sort of personified into this Greek chorus and have a relationship with her, and that's how she can sort of feel things and sort of see things coming in terms of earthquakes. And the play sort of puts those two worlds together in a really fun, exciting / scary kind of way.
Okay, so Deborah, I have to ask, what is an empath?
An empath? Oh, well, I mean, according to this playwright, she is someone who can sense when earthquakes occur. So she has like an extrasensory perception of her of the earth. Like basically, she's a really heightened listener, and she can all of the senses kind of go through her body. So certain physical effects occur when an earthquake is getting closer, and she sees shadows and light and static electricity, like emitting from cats and different kinds of things, like the closer that earthquake comes. And this is really the world of the playwright, Angela Santillo, who has really created this wonderful world of kind of her own rules about what would occur if an empath could sense the next big one.
What time is it?
Why are you yelling?
What?
Why are you yelling?
I told you before, I yell before an earthquake.
Oh, right, that all-day screamer thing. Oh, wait, does that mean an earthquake is about to happen right now?
Shadows!
Where?
And the fault lines are gods. So what's the is that correct?
I think that's the correct. I keep referring to them as gods rather than fault lines because they do carry an incredible amount of power over the characters and the fate of this specific empath. They do have supernatural powers to a certain extent, but then they're at the same time very human, which is something that I really appreciate. They eat In-N-Out burgers. They watch, you know, porn shoots, and they, you know, have worries about if people are going to like them. And that's what's so imaginative about what Angela has done, is sort of taken these powers that we can't even imagine what they might be like, that feel sort of at another realm for us in real life, and sort of put personalities on them in a way that we can understand what it might be like to have this hunger for shaking.
What's the personality of the San Andreas Fault?
I'll answer that because he's very affecting. It's very serious. He's passionate. He's powerful.
My name.
Los Angeles.
San Andreas.
My bones.
San Andreas.
Andreas.
San Andreas?
It feels like he's found in this new age a fascination with fame and Hollywood. So he's the closest thing to a Hollywood mogul, I guess, we have in the play to a certain extent. And he loves the idea that he has these huge earthquakes and people know about him. And he seems to have a certain hunger for that. And we'll see how that in different ways manifests itself in the production.
Now, that also seems like a very California mm-hmm. theme in the play. Mm-hmm. And there's another one that when I read the description, mm-hmm. there you're as the empath, Deborah, you're trying to convince a scientist to believe you, to believe that the big one is coming.
Yeah.
That kind of conversation between the New Age perspective and the scientific perspective also, to me, seems very Californian.
Absolutely. You know, I mean, both are so strong, really. And this idea also that something has to be proven before, you know, left brain, right brain, like the rational and what would be considered perhaps irrational or tribal or primal. And so Angela has written these two characters, this empath and then this Caltech grad student, Mitch, played by Sam Burtkin, who just has to have the science of it. And, where is the proof? And so they interact and learn from each other in a really interesting way, you know. And I think that's something that audience members will really be drawn to, is this conflict and interesting stress, if you will, between like the primal and our developed society. You know, the idea that, you know, and Los Angeles is such an icon of mid-20th century, and all that we did, you know, fast food and freeways and, all of that love of humanity and what we can do. And then an earthquake, which is the most primal thing that we have in California, can just destroy all that at any moment. So that awareness of both those things, we live here and we kind of thrive off of that, you know, those two opposites.
I'm speaking with Evren Ochakin and Deborah Eliezer. We're talking today about a play called Faulted, which is a new play about the Big One. And the play is set in Los Angeles, but it's actually the production is happening in San Francisco.
Yes, we actually talked about that quite a bit. We're like, well, it's funny, we're, you know, on the Andreas Fault as well. And, you know, there were all those things that came out, the story that came out recently about how the Andreas Fault is about to go in the Bay Area. But the playwright is originally from Los Angeles, and that was sort of her first experience with a big earthquake. And it's really nice in the sense that we're sort of trying to find this great storytelling where the play leans into a lot of the Los Angeles stereotypes. The fault lines are these sort of almost caricatures visually of different Los Angeles stereotypes, whether it be a beach girl or a beach bum or a Hollywood Boulevard wanderer, you know, punk kid. But at the same time, the play is really about what it's like to really live in Los Angeles. So we're sort of balancing that as well between sort of the stereotypes of a lot of Northern Californians. You know, we have certain ideas around Los Angeles and Southern California, and also really trying to tell the story of what it's really like to live there. If you were born and raised there, what it's really like to live in Los Angeles.
Do you think this is La La Land?
I have no idea what that means.
The tourists and plastic transplants think this city is paradise, but there is nothing la-la about Los Angeles. The sky is brown. The grass is not really green. The hillsides spontaneously fall, and the ocean reminds you there's an end to everything. We have droughts, superpower winds, and our leaves don't change. Instead of autumn, we get hills of fire that make the air taste like a fireplace.
And now, Deborah, are you you're a Bay Area native?
I am. I'm a native San Franciscan.
What's it like for you to be thinking so much about L.A.? I mean, there's this, you know, rivalry between L.A. and San Francisco.
You know, it's funny. The San Andreas Fault Line, which plays a very big part, a character and a very big narrative arc in the play, is over 700 miles long. So it spans Los Angeles to California. And so I'm actually seeing a lot of comparisons between, I mean, when we talk about earthquakes, I'm just feeling this great connection to Los Angeles in perhaps a way I haven't before. You know, if you've lived through an earthquake, it's sort of a great equalizer. You know, if you lived through an earthquake in L.A. versus San Francisco, similar things were happening to your body. You had the same fears. You had the same, you know, perceptions, no matter where you were. Even Evren talks about living through one in Turkey, you know, and quite a big one. And it, all of us can have the same conversation of what it's like as a human, you know. So I think it's a very accessible play in that way. The content of it reaches us. So if you come, you'll experience something. And I think you'll have, you know, you'll come away with maybe different ideas about earthquakes or yourself or emergency preparedness or just enjoy a good night out. Because another thing we haven't said is it's a funny play.
It is really funny. Actually, that is so true. And that's one of the fun things about it is, you know, the big one is coming. That's a really serious thing. We know what that means if an 8.3 earthquake is going to happen in a place like Los Angeles with that many people living there. But then the playwright sort of digs into a comedy of that comes out of stress sometimes, and sometimes out of these personalities that would not ever come together, but they have to because this big thing is coming. And then how do they communicate with each other? And that's what's so fun for all the actors and for myself as a director is figuring out the storytelling that can support both of those things.
That was Evren Ojikin and Deborah Eleazar talking to KALW's Julie Kane. And thanks to Alexa Luna Torres for help producing that interview. Faulted opens Monday at the Thick House Theater in San Francisco. For more information, go to KALW.org and click on Cross Currents. This next piece comes to us from San Francisco's StoryCorps. Shortly after World War II in Eastern Europe, Slobodan Dampić was just a boy, and he says life felt void of color. He remembers the moment light came back in. It was all thanks to a certain musical tale about a dark-haired beauty named Tosca.
I was born in Belgrade in Yugoslavia immediately after the Second World War. And Belgrade was bombed by everyone. Everything was literally gray, from food to clothes to people. People were sort of numbed and hardworking, and there was very little joy, or at least, you know, in my environment. But my mother took me to the opera when I was five, and it was Tosca, and we were late. So when we got to the theater, they took us to the top of the theater, because that's where the latecomers go, and they let us in. And I looked down, all the way down, and suddenly there was color. It was, you know, the first act of Tosca, and it's sort of in some church, sort of it's a Baroque setting. And I looked at it and I thought, oh my God, the real life is there. This is just a mistake which needs to be corrected. So this impression of the real color and real life kind of stayed with me.
That's Slobodan Dampić. His story came to us from San Francisco's StoryCorps. That's it for today's Cross Currents from KALW News. Our team includes Isabel Angel, Olivia Cueva, Nina Gensler-Debs, Audrey Dilling, Sandhya Dirks, Rachel Dornhelm, Chris Hoff, Angela Johnston, Ashley Ann Krigbaum, Christina Loring, Stephen Short, Liza Veal, and Melanie Young. Today's show was engineered by Seth Samuel. The line producer was Leela Day. Our managing editor is Jen Chien. Managing producer is Julie Kane. Ben Trefney is our news director. Tune into Cross Currents tomorrow at 5 to find out how a prison arts program is transforming lives.
I am Oscar Grant. I am Hadia Pendleton. I am Sandy Hook Elementary. I am Trayvon Martin. I am Michael Butler. I am you.
The Brothers in Penn, tomorrow at 5 on Cross Currents from KALW News. This is the Bay Area's Ives Quartet. You can hear them at the Old First Church on Sacramento Street in San Francisco this Friday night. The annual hometown show starts at 8 o'clock. For Cross Currents, I'm Hanat Baba.